afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, I'll be talking with artistic director Kevin Fryer and lecturer Bruce Lamotte about Live at Mission Blue in Brisbane, whose opening concert features the male vocal group Clear Story. Theatre Calgary artistic director Dennis Garnham talks about his stint here at ACT directing George Bernard Shaw's Major Barbara. Dance maker and artistic director Liz Fain from the eponymously named dance company shares details about their latest offering. Plus, Peter Robinson, our bon vivant and man about town, updates viewers on season 4 of Downton Abbey and shares his reviews of a couple of current movies, American Hustle and Philomena. Stay with us.
The sun had not yet risen.
The sea was indistinguishable from the sky, except that the sea was slightly creased,
as if a cloth had wrinkles in it.
Gradually, as the sky whitened, a dark line lay on the horizon,
dividing the sea from the sky.
And the gray cloth became barred with thick strokes,
moving one after another,
beneath the surface,
following each other,
pursuing each other,
perpetually.
Actors Val Sinclair and Marty Pistone giving voice to the words of Virginia Woolf in this excerpt from Liz Fain Dance Company's world premiere of After the Light. It's an immersive performance installation with text by Virginia Woolf, choreographed by Liz Fain. Performances run tonight through Sunday at Z Space on Florida Street in San Francisco. And I'm delighted to welcome Liz Fain to the KLW studios. Originally from Providence, Rhode Island, Liz founded Liz Fain Dance in 1988 and has created some 45 works in close collaboration with video artists, filmmakers, composers, visual designers, and actors. Her work has been performed all around the world, and since 2010, Liz has created immersive performance installations that are presented in theatrical venues, unusual architectural structures, art galleries, libraries, where the audience is inside the set, immersive sound environment, set walking around or seated close to the performers. And I'm so happy that she can take a little bit of time here to talk about this interesting way approach to dance. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome to the studios.
Thank you.
This is an unusual way to present dance. Now, was this the original way that you conceived of a dance company back in Boston in 1988?
No, although in Boston, I was working with people at the MIT Center for Advanced Visual Studies, and I was working with videographers doing performances in various locations on site throughout the university, and the dancers would be, the images would be projected throughout the university. So we were kind of experimenting with that sort of thing. When I moved here, I was doing just regular proscenium performances. And finally, one day in 2010, I thought, you know what? It's time to do something different.
Hmm. Well, talk about this particular work, After the Light. What is it all about?
It's about the shifting relationships between people, how you define yourself through your relationships with other people. I started out wanting to work with the idea of boundaries that you create for yourself, and how you perceive those boundaries, if you perceive them at all, if you perceive them as changeable. When I started working with The Waves by Virginia Woolf, I realized that she took that idea but turned it into a whole fluid narrative about relationships and how people's relationships help them define who they are.
And so this is kind of a continuation of the idea that you'd had behind the waves in Virginia Woolf's text as well.
Yes.
So I'm curious about the choreography itself. Since this is an immersive experience with the audience moving around, are the dancers committed to a set routine, or is there some improvisation involved? Do their movements change from performance to performance? Is there a broad outline of what they're to do?
The dance is set. It is not improvised. The only unknown element of this piece is what the audience is going to do. And for me, that's what makes immersive installation work really, really interesting, because the audience sees the dancers and they also see each other. And any performer responds to the energy of an audience, even an unseen audience in a proscenium. So when an audience is right there close to you, your response is much more immediate and much more visceral as a performer. But the audience moving around creates a whole new element to the piece, because you are looking at the dance, which is completely set, and you're also very aware of what is around the periphery of the dance.
And so when one walks into Z-Space, do you have the option of sitting down, or is it...
No.
You don't have the option?
You do not have the option. We have removed the chairs. You have got to enter the set.
And are the dancers already in place, or do they come amongst the dance?
No, it starts out as an installation. The dancers are in place, and I actually created the beginning of the piece as an installation that was inspired by a passage from another Virginia Woolf book, To the Lighthouse, where she also has a lot of water imagery. And the passage I used was the passage near the end where Mr. Ramsay is looking out towards the lighthouse, and his wife has died, and he hasn't gone to the lighthouse during her life, and he's this very solitary man who needs help and can't ask for it. And so I started it almost as an image of someone looking out and looking back at the same time and reflecting. And then the dance starts and they're in their lives.
So let's talk about this artistic obsession, as it were, with Virginia Woolf. How did does her writing lend itself to dance, or do you have a personal affinity towards her style?
Well, I love Virginia Woolf, but
not afraid of her at all.
No, I've always loved Virginia Woolf, thanks to my 10th grade English teacher. But I, when I use literature, I try to use literature that's not narrative, that leaves a lot of space for me as a dance maker to create movement that isn't necessarily following a story. And there aren't a lot of authors who fit that. So when I was reading and thinking about, well, whom could I use, whose work could I use, I started reading Moments of Being by Virginia Woolf, which was published posthumously. And I then just thought, oh, you know what? I think I'll go back and reread The Waves. And I started reading it, and I thought, oh, this is really perfect, because there's a narrative, but it's really much more about the whole concept of life changing and the energy of people changing throughout their lives, and how they experience the world because of the changes in who they are at that moment.
Well, now you got me curious about The Waves. I'm going to have to revisit it myself. So let's talk about your collaborative creative team here.
They're great. Dan Wool is the composer.
We heard his music starting off, and we will shortly.
Yes, and he and I start working right from the beginning of the piece. He starts coming into rehearsal, seeing what I'm doing. We talk about the writing. I start choosing which passages I want. I print them out. I give them to him. I give them to the dancers. He starts just coming up with musical ideas that in the beginning are very, very vague. And so it's hard to see from our perspective where he's headed. So what's really wonderful about working with him is that he knows where he's headed and we can't see it. And then suddenly he brings in a version of the score, and it's just so rich and dynamic. And Matthew works with us, but he, you know, the set is something that he does more on his own. And we start talking and saying, well, I want an environment that feels almost as if it's both a period piece and also as if it is not confined, constrained by a time period. So there's a lot of back and forth discussion between Matthew and myself, and he came up with this idea of a series of arches. And when he did, I thought that was perfect. That was it. So he created a series of arches. And the costume designer is there from the beginning also. She's very much a part of the development of what this piece needs to look like, who these people are. We started out going in one direction with the costumes, being very abstract and then making them very realistic. And then suddenly she hit upon an idea that I'm not going to tell you because it's so wonderful, but it's absolutely perfect. And it's just sort of balances the line between very personal and a little abstract.
Well, we'll have to check it out ourselves then at Z-Space. It's After the Light, an immersive performance installation, text by Virginia Woolf, choreographed by my guest, Liz Fain. Now let's talk about the dancers involved. Is this a core dance company that is everyone involved in this particular work? Do you use selected members? How does your company work?
I've been working with the same core group of six dancers for the past 3 years. So we know each other very well, and we work very, very well together. They're all very skilled technicians, but what I think sets them apart as dancers is that they understand how to just use the technique as a foundation for building movement that is both very personal and very dynamic. Usually I come into rehearsal and I have movement I've created, but then they take it and they change it so it's almost not recognizable from what I started out with. So it's very much a collaboration between the dancers and myself.
And so they're contributing ideas throughout the process.
Yeah, and I'll bring in movement. Like, I had one phrase that I called the death of Virginia Woolf, and I said, and here's where she gets the rocks, and she puts them in her pocket, and here's where she jumps in the river. And we were kind of laughing because it was so narrative. And then they each took it in a direction that was very different from where I began. And the dance actually ends with one of the dancers' version of that. And, you know, there are certain things that you can say, oh, yeah, that's what I brought. That's where I started. And I think, how did she ever come up with this, with what I started?
So, Liz, this work is for the 2014 season of Liz Fain Dance. Is it an annual project? Do you have one major work that you mount every year? Are there other projects that happen throughout the year in different places? How does the company
work?
Well,
usually I mount one major work, and then I try to take it to different places. One of the interesting aspects of doing installation work is that it changes depending on the place you perform it in. You know, we have to change the configuration of the space. We can use more or less of a set depending on where we are. So it's interesting for all of us to work in that way.
And the performances run through Sunday at Z Space on Florida Street in San Francisco. You can find out about tickets or information at a couple of different websites, zspace.org or at lisfaindance.org. That's lisfaindance.org. Liz Fain Dance opens the 2014 home season featuring the world premiere of After the Light. Let's hear a little bit more music from that as we thank you for coming in today, Liz.
Thank you.
I wish you a spectacular run of this.
Thank you.
music of Dan Wool, featured throughout Liz Fain Dance's production of After the Light at Z-Space. Again, information for these performances through Sunday at zspace.org or lizfaindance.org. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW. Still to come, Theatre Calgary Artistic Director Dennis Garnham will be talking about his stint here at ACT, directing George Bernard Shaw's what's considered as one of his greatest works, Major Barbara, at ACT. Plus, Peter Robinson is going to talk about Downton Abbey and a couple of current movie reviews on American Hustle and Philomena before our hour's out. And next, we'll be talking with Artistic Director Kevin Fryer and Lecturer Bruce Lamotte about Live at Mission Blue. Kevin Fryer is Artistic Director of Mission Blue. In 2003, he founded Live at Mission Blue concert series, co-sponsored by the City of Brisbane and the Friends of the Brisbane Library. It brings international artists to the community of Brisbane at affordable ticket prices. Mr. Fryer is also on the boards of the San Francisco Early Music Society and Early Music America, and he's also regarded as one of the leading harpsichord makers in North America, particularly making Zuckerman harpsichords. He has served as harpsichord technician for Carmel Bach Festival, music at Menlo, San Francisco Ballet and Opera, among others. And it's a pleasure to welcome him to our studios. He's joined by Bruce Lamotte, lecturer and program advisor for Live at Mission Bay. Bruce is director of the Philharmonia Chorale, the professional chorus of the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, and was former choral director and harpsichordist at the Carmel Bach Festival. I imagine some similar circles are communicating there. He's been heard as lecturer for the San Francisco Opera Guild when the focus has been on Handel and operas of the 18th century. And he teaches at the San Francisco University High School and the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Gentlemen, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Well, let's talk about a place that I'm completely unfamiliar with, Live at Mission Blue. Maybe, Kevin, you can tell us how this series even got started down there.
Well, thanks, David. I live in Brisbane, and there was a new community center being built around 2002, 2003, and I would bicycle around Brisbane and pass by it, look through the window, and I thought to myself, this looks like a perfect space for live chamber music. Who do I need to talk to? And around the same time, the City of Brisbane had put into place a policy that if you lived in Brisbane and were an artist, they would co-sponsor any project that you wanted to do.
Fantastic.
So I went to the city council meeting and I said, "Hi, I'm Kevin Fryer. I'm a harpsichord maker. I live here in Brisbane. And I think Mission Blue Center might potentially be a perfect space for chamber music." And they looked at me a little strangely, but said, "Okay, go ahead." And we did two trial concerts, and they were an enormous success. The space turns out to be perfectly suited acoustically and visually for intimate chamber music settings.
About how many can be seated? Or
we can seat about 170, up to 170.
That's a good size space.
Yeah, it's a good size space. Immediately after the success of those two trial concerts, I went back to the city council and said, "Okay, look, I'd like to start a concert series here in Brisbane." And since then, the city council has always been terribly, terribly supportive of it. And now the community is very proud to have this world-class concert series in our little town of Brisbane.
The series consists this season of, I believe, four concerts.
Four concerts,
opening with Clear Story. Now, how did you select the groups to perform in this year's series?
Well, Clear Story has performed once before, so I knew they were an audience favorite. And coming up on our 10th season, when I was looking for something really spectacular to kick off the season, I went back to Clear Story and said, "How would you like to perform here again?" And of course, they jumped at the opportunity. The space is wonderful for voices. Voices sound just beautiful in it. So that's how we decided to start the season. Cypress String Quartet actually approached us. One of their board members had came to one of our concerts and said, then approached me through Bruce and said, "You know, we're looking for alternate places to perform. Would you like to come to talk to us about presenting us at Mission Blue?" The third group, Jarring Sounds, we're calling it an emerging artist slot, although I believe these artists have fully emerged. They're two musicians who are recent graduates of the conservatory, and I have been really looking for this next generation of performers. I had the opportunity to hear them perform and thought they would be really a great match. And the last concert was presented to me by Lorna Peters. She had come before, performed with an orchestra, chamber orchestra, and she approached me about doing a project with Jubal Folks, and so we thought that would be a nice way to end the season.
And that ends on April 12th. All information about the full series can be found at liveatmissionblue.com. Bruce Lamott is a lecturer and program advisor for Live at Mission Bay. Bruce, how do you work in your aspect of the presentations?
Well, the pleasure is all mine. I get to meet the artists. One thing about musicians, they love to talk about their work, and it's the kind of thing that you don't read in program notes. All you need to do is get a cellist to start talking about the cello, and you're good for a half an hour.
I've done some similar pre-concert talks, and it's very helpful that way.
Absolutely, and I've got to say, I live in the city, not in Brisbane like Kevin, and I've got to say, as a city rat, this place just kind of won me over. There used to be an ad on the radio that was Farms in Berkeley, and I want to say chamber music in Brisbane. I mean, that's an exit we see on the way to the airport.
Right.
It turns out that you wind your way up on the shoulders of Mount San Bruno into this deadly still. You will never hear a siren. You will never hear a bus or a trolley. It's free parking, and we haven't mentioned yet that tickets are $20. But there's a kind of decompression that goes all the time you're driving as you get away from the city lights. And by the time you're there for this absolutely wonderful magic environment in Mayberry, all these wonderful townspeople just come out, and some of them are chamber music aficionados, some of them are the idly curious. And there's a tremendous, it's like going to a pancake breakfast with world-class chamber music. It's
very nice.
Wonderful place.
Now, Kevin, your main shingle, so to speak, has been as a harpsichord builder. We actually have one of the Zuckermans in our house. It was built by Steve Dibner, who's the second bassoonist of the San Francisco Symphony. He built it when he was a Juilliard student. When did you first become obsessed with harpsichords? And it has to be an obsession.
Well, as I like to tell people, my day job is I'm a harpsichord maker. And I've been doing it professionally for 30 years now. I started professionally in 1984. And originally, I was an agent for Zuckerman Harpsichords, and I did that. That was sort of my apprenticeship. I did that for 7-8 years before then I took off on my own and have been building since. And that experience, so of course I build instruments, but also I provide instruments for concerts and tune for concerts and so on. That experience has put me in most of the major and minor performance spaces in the Greater Bay Area. I did a long stint with Philharmonic Baroque Orchestra. I did a long stint with Carmel Bach Festival. I currently am the harpsichord technician, supply harpsichords for Music at Menlo, a wonderful summer festival.
Yeah.
And that's given me that experience in concert hall spaces and sort of an awareness of what makes a good concert hall space. And so when I saw Mission Blue Center, I recognized it immediately as a space that would be great for
so music. As a builder and a technician of harpsichords, are you looking at the different spaces that these are being performed as, oh, it has to be this instrument, or oh no, we're going to use this instrument here because of the space? Do you have different instruments?
Oh,
different
I don't think
spaces?
There's so much of a differentiation about that, although harpsichord itself as an instrument does need a particularly live and intimate space. If you hear a solo harpsichord at Davies Hall, it's a little bit aloof from the spaces higher up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a really good acoustic will accommodate a wide range of instruments, not just different styles of harpsichord making, but solo guitar, solo lute, voices, and so on. I think that Mission Blue Center, acoustically, it begins to get a little too loud if you put a 9-foot Steinway grand in there. I think maybe that might be a little too much for that
sure.
space.
And that's Kevin Fryer, Artistic Director of Live at Mission Blue. He's here with Bruce Lamott, Lecturer Program Advisor, also a harpsichordist. So, Bruce, I understand you do some work with the San Francisco Opera Marilla program, talking about realization of harpsichord for accompanying.
That's right, David.
Could you share with our audience what that means? I mean, people think, well, all the notes are usually there. You just play them, right? But not so. Not at all.
In fact, my course is called Harpsichord Survival. And what you realize is the Maryland Opera Program, which brings in every year 5 really virtuoso keyboard accompanists, in addition to these wonderful singers who are the stars of tomorrow. And most of them are very accomplished pianists, and not quite as much now, but they used to be terrified of the harpsichord. Not only terrified, but hostile, because it was full of things they knew they should have learned when they were in school, and all it was laden with Baroque performance practice. And basically, I'm trying to teach them the nitty-gritty of playing recitative in opera, and to get over the idea that somebody is footnoting and writing their DMA thesis on the way that they are realizing or playing the harmonies for a Mozart opera. Kind of letting them realize that playing, if you play a Mozart opera, it's much more like playing theater organ than it is playing a Couperin suite on the harpsichord. So that's my job, is basically kind of deconditioning them from their fears and anxieties about the instrument.
And then welcoming audience members to Mission Blue Center and helping them understand what the concert's all about. Again, the opening concert of the 2014 season of Live at Mission Blue. Information at liveatmissionblue.com. This Saturday at 8 p.m., the 9-man vocal ensemble Clear Story will be performing, again, under the auspices of the Brisbane Public Library. Mission Blue Center is on Mission Blue Drive. Information at liveatmissionblue.com. Kevin Fryer, Bruce Lamont, thanks for taking a little time to share with us.
Thank you, David.
We are going to go out with a little music of Clear Story and then hear about Major Barbara at ACT. Stay tuned. Through February 2nd, the American Conservatory Theater, ACT, is co-producing with Theater Calgary a production of George Bernard Shaw's Major Barbara. Written and first performed in 1905, the topics explored include the timely themes of business, philanthropy, family, and morality. With me to talk about the production is Dennis Garnham, Theater Calgary's artistic director. Prior to his appointment at Theater Calgary in 2005, Dennis spent some time directing in New York and at the Long Wharf Theater, where he worked on the development of the opera Brundibar by Tony Kushner and Maurice Sendak. Further operatic credits include La Traviata, Carmen, and The Barber of Seville. He's now in San Francisco in his directing debut at ACT, directing his bi-national cast of Americans and Canadians for this production of Major Barbara. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
A brief synopsis, if you would be so kind, of Major Barbara.
Sure. Major Barbara is one of Shaw's, I'd call it simply his masterpiece. It's the story of, it starts very simply. A mother gathers her children and says, "Dad, who's left the house 20 years ago, he's coming home tonight because he's a munitions factory billionaire and we need some more money from him. So we're going to invite him over just to say hello and to see if we can connect, because you're all going off to be married and you need money." So what she doesn't expect is they actually like the guy. They get very excited by him. And one of the daughter, Barbara, is a major in the Salvation Army. And so she and him hit it off pretty quickly. And she says to Dad, "Dad, why don't you come down to my Salvation Army and take a look at what the great work we do here?" And he says, "Deal, if you come to where I make bombs."
Hmm.
That's the simple premise of the piece.
Well, it's a morality play of sort, but it's also called one of Shaw's wittiest plays.
It's very, very, very funny. I think Shaw cleverly kind of sneaks in, like sneaks the bombs in and sneaks the terror in just when you least expect it. And I think why it's so funny is that he does surround it around this family. It's actually a family. Anybody who's had a mother or a father in their life would understand this piece, right? So he makes it very human. I think when you think of Shaw, you think of the big ideas and the moral ideas and socialism and all these epic things. But he does something beautiful in this play, which is he centers it around a family. And I think this, for me, the surprise of the play is that the ideas are hanging on dad, mom, brother, sister, and our place in our family. So that's something we've really focused on in working on the piece.
So how is the humor being interwoven? I mean, we can always think of family situations where that comes in, but how is...
Well, humor is always truthful. Humor comes out of truth. So in this piece, I think you either get it because the children are saying things they shouldn't say or behaving the way they shouldn't say. And inversely, when Dad speaks about war and poverty and points out the absurdity of what he's seeing, it kind of twists things. And the fun of it is actually really the mashup of these two ideas and these two groups of people. So I think if you laugh at anything, you're laughing at the honesty of it all.
So is there a particular approach that you use when introducing actors who aren't familiar with Shaw's writing, or do you just let his writing do the work?
Great question. The bottom line is, it's a great piece of work. It doesn't need us to fix it. You know, I've done a lot of work. I've done a lot of obscure pieces. I've done newer. And when you do those pieces, you're trying to figure out how to shape the event. Shaw knows what this event is. He knows what the story is. So, in fact, we didn't... If you always believe you're in the hands of great writing, it changes how you do work. Our job was to unearth really what's there. So, I mean, I think more than anything, when you work on a classic, I think the best thing you can do is stop worrying about it being a masterpiece. Just trust that it's well written and trust that you'll figure it out and make it human. So we've tried to avoid getting too precious about the Shaw-isms, you know. I think, however, I've asked everybody to make it personal. You know, going back to this notion of family, our first day of rehearsal, we spent a lot of time talking about our families. We sat in a circle and I said, this is an international collaboration. Half this cast is Canadian, half are Americans. We've never met. Who are you? Tell me about your family. And within mere minutes, people were sharing the most dramatic, surprising... everyone has a story, and everyone's family is extraordinarily unique and confronting and beautiful and frightening. And I think what I learned on that day is this play is no different than that. And I think, again, it goes back to why we relate to it. So when we started rehearsing the play, I just asked everybody just to really listen to what's actually going on, not what we think is going on.
Well, let's back up to that casting process. How exactly were auditions held, and how did you base your selection?
Well, it's a great question. So this production actually began in a concept about a year and a half, 2 years ago, when I talked to Carrie Perloff, the artistic director, and said, I'd like to do Major Barbara, and I'm going to be doing it with this great Canadian actor, Dean Paul Gibson. Would you be interested in partnering and creating a new collaboration? To which, in Carrie fashion, she took about 1.1 seconds and said, absolutely, this is thrilling, let's do it. You know, we realized that a Canadian company and an American company partnering on a British play was this really exciting collaboration. So what we did was we really wanted to make sure we balanced it out. And we had, you know, as basic or blunt as it is, Dad, the undershaft, played by a Canadian, we said, well, then Barbara must be American. And so I actually went across. We first looked here in San Francisco, and then we went to New York, and we saw 40 extraordinary women for this role, 40 of which I was...
Binders of women.
Binders.
Binders of women were used.
You know, they one after another, and they were all there. Actually, they were all quite good, you know, and there was 10 that were really quite great, and there was 3 that I got very excited about. then we left that process in New York. We went back to our homes 2 days later. We were about to do the next set of callbacks. And then Gretchen Hall's video submission came in. And this is somebody we'd been trying to line up to come in, but she was in rehearsal of a show, so she couldn't come in. And so I'd basically given up on that she would be on the list. And so after these 40 people, Gretchen Hall's video came in, and with about 5 seconds of watching her video, she got the job. It was that clear and immediate that she was an extraordinary choice.
Now, this same production is being staged at Theatre Calgary after the ACT run. Is it the exact same cast and the exact same sets? What's being transported from San Francisco versus being built in Calgary?
One of the reasons this is so thrilling is that both companies are creating the project together. So a few years ago, ACT presented Tosca Cafe, and I was there opening night here in San Francisco, and I loved it. And so I said to Carrie, would you please bring it up to Canada? So she did about 2 years ago. That was a little different because that was really ACT's production visiting Canada, more or less. What's unique about this is this: from day one, it's been a partnership. So half the designers are Canadian, half are American. So everything you will see on our stage here at ACT, everything is coming up. So we've been enjoying and pointing out to each other the Canadian-Americanisms. In rehearsals, somebody will make a joke, well, he's being Canadian right now, or that's an American response. So we're trying to learn each other's countries. And the Canadians have been, we've all fallen madly in love with, first and foremost, ACT, and second, this extraordinary city, of course. But what we're very excited about is in about a month's time, once the run ends, we're going to take this whole company up into the cold and snow of frigid Calgary, in the Rocky Mountains. And many of them have never been, the Americans have not been up. Uh-huh. So very excited. And I'm also very excited to see the big changes, the audience. How will the Canadian audience respond to this? I know that ACT has a very smart, willing, excited audience. And my audience in Calgary has always been very committed. So I think that's going to be interesting to see how that cultural shift is. Do they laugh in the same spots? Do they have the same response? Is there a difference? I think that's really going to be an exciting thing to explore.
You mentioned not being getting your actors bogged down in the Shaw-isms or being George Bernard Shaw with all capital letters going on. Now, this was originally staged in 1905. Did any of the language have to be tweaked a little bit to contemporize it? And how are you setting the production?
Full disclosure, we are not saying every word in this play. If we did, it would be 3.5 hours long. And I don't think we need to. I mean, I think Shaw is a brilliant writer, but I also think in some cases less is more. So I take full, and I've told, everyone, I take full responsibility for the cutting down of this. So it's going to run about 230, 240, and with all the ideas intact. And so, and there's also a lot of references that his audience, of course, would understand, like Shakespeare. There's no way you can say a sentence and have an audience understand it, no matter what we do. So we've tried, but we've cleverly kind of tightened it up. You won't even think that that's happened. But so what's exciting about the production, I think, in terms of the setting, is that we've very much of the, set in 1905 in England, in these locations. But what we've tried to do is set it in a very theatrical world. So the designs by Dan Osling are extraordinary. Everybody who sees pictures or now it's on stage are quite surprised. Everyone says, I didn't expect it to be that exciting, which is hopefully what we're expecting from the audience seeing the play, the experience of the play. Everybody who comes to watch a run or watches us in rehearsal, everyone says, this play is more exciting than I thought it was. My response is, it's a masterpiece. There's a reason why they retain their strength. So it's very much set in period, but you'll see stylistically it's a very imaginative and abstract setting that's very full of ideas.
And again, working with Shaw's text, you're more concerned about choreographing maybe than directing your cast.
Yeah, it's trying to move through the ideas, right? Because Shaw loads the play with very strong characters with very strong opinions. And you can't just have a night of people preaching. So the challenge has always been, where do we modulate this so we warm up the ideas, so it feels much more like a light conversation, and where do we need to stop and make a point? So that's really where we spent most of our energy, so that it still has the impact. And in the middle of the last act, when the father is standing with his children in his bomb factory, and he's talking about war and poverty, and he says the greatest crime is poverty. you can hear a pin drop, because he's so upset and so adamant that this world is upside down. And as we've been noticing being here in San Francisco, and as I know in my home city, you know, the war on poverty is we're losing.
As timely in 1905 as it is in 2014.
Shocking. Those words, you know, those words. And the reason why we still laugh and we still will be shocked is the words haven't changed and over 100 years ago, and we're still feeling the same. It's shocking.
It's Dennis Garnham. He's directing Major Barbara at ACT, a co-production with Theatre Calgary. Dennis is the artistic director of Theatre Calgary, making his directing debut with a bi-national cast here in San Francisco. In addition to the performances of Major Barbara, which run through February 2nd, ACT is offering a number of innovative interactive events, including Bike to the Theatre Night on January 23rd, Theatre on the Couch on Friday, January 17th, in which you can discuss with Dr. Mason Turner, Chief of Psychiatry at San Francisco's Kaiser Permanente Medical Center, the behaviors of the characters, if you so desire. Out with ACT is on Wednesday, January 22nd, with the best LGBT night in town. You can learn about all these special events, including a wine series night, at their website, act-sf.org. Dennis, thank you so much for coming in today, and I wish you a spectacular run.
Thank you. See you there.
That may be familiar to some if you've caught Downton fever, as I have. That's the theme to Downton Abbey. Peter Robinson, our bon vivant and man about town, will update us about season 4 and offer a couple of movie reviews. Hi there, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be back. And of course, the music automatically makes me say, welcome to Downton Abbey.
Indeed. Indeed.
All I need is one of those chauffeured cars to drive up the pathway and then have a host of staff not only to open my door, but clean my shoes, show me in, and off we go.
Indeed. It is a marvelous illusion they're creating at the opening of everyone, because you would think that everything's being done right there. But as you know, it's filmed in several different locations.
That's right. Yeah, part of it.
Stock shots.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Part of it is filmed in London at the Ealing Studios. In fact, those are the downstairs shots. And then the upstairs, they do use the library and the dining room of Highclere Castle. So there is that sense of authenticity. And of course, just to recap, people who saw the end of season 3 will, of course, remember it began with the death of Matthew Crawley, played by Dan Stevens. He's killed suddenly in a car crash, leaving his wife, Lady Mary, essentially in mourning. So that's where the story picks up. And just in case people are wanting to blame Julian Fellowes, Matthew Crawley, or Dan Stevens, the actor, actually decided he wanted to leave the series. So you're then left as a scriptwriter with two choices. You can either get a stand-in lookalike, or else you have to create a reason for the particular cast actor's departure. And in his case, it was a car crash.
And in leaving the series doesn't leave an option for him to come back as a ghost either, does it?
As a ghost.
Oh, well.
No, mind you, you never know who creeps into whose bedroom at night.
I think when Shirley MacLaine was on set, she said that the actual Abbey is being haunted. She was visited by some former spirits.
Yes, probably herself.
Indeed.
So we've moved the story up to 1922. It's post-war Britain's boom, post-First World War Britain's boom. It's a time of mass unemployment. It's also a time of political upheaval, economic crisis, and technological progress. Does that all sound familiar to us today? And in the opening scene between Maggie Smith, who, of course, is the Dowager Countess, and the butler, we hear those immortal words, "It's a changing world." And I think what we're looking at in series four is how the nature of change impacts on a hierarchical society where everybody definitely knows their place. There's a line I like to quote from a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, and in this, a person asks the member of the House of Lords, "Tell me, sir, what do you do?" He replies, "Nothing in particular, but I do it particularly well." And I think definitely Lord Grantham has his day, his work, and his life cut out for him.
Well, that reminds me also of one of the my favorite Maggie Smith lines from the series, "Weekend? What is a weekend?
What is a weekend?" That's right. So we're into that type of society, but it's a society which I've already mentioned changes happening. And, of course, one of it relates to women receiving recognition in both political and economic field. And this, of course, is the backstory to this series, because Lady Mary, who is in mourning, essentially doesn't want to participate in her life. She has, of course, the young son, suddenly found halfway through the series that she's now being empowered. And again, one of those stories that hinges on a letter announces that she, in fact, can claim a half right to the entire estate. So at that point, she's back in the saddle and she's there helping Lord Grantham, whether in fact he does or doesn't want help, but he gets it.
Well, it's going to be interesting how Julian Fellowes handles the whole Lord Grantham theme throughout this season. You mentioned change and how he's really of an older school. It's going to be interesting to see how he does not make him just a grumpy old man, to see how he evolves in this season.
Yes, he's got a sort of genial personality. He treats everybody fairly. In fact, fairness, I think, is one of the words that he uses frequently. And this, of course, applies to the tenant farmers. Part of that change that we're witnessing is a tenant farmer will eventually want to own his own house. He wants to be responsible. And that's one of the key issues which comes out in the estate management. Another example of change, this time from downstairs, Mrs. Patmore, the cook, suddenly finds she has to deal with a electric cake mixer. And electricity has impacted the story. We've earlier seen the use of the telephone. Electricity is running through the house. And this is an England which didn't easily take to change. Change came much more quickly in this country, where people didn't necessarily have servants, but sometimes some of the gadgets meant some servant folk were going to be put out of a job. In fact, I've just been reading an excellent book called The Servants. And one man's sole job in one of these country estates was to ring the gong. So he would be up at breakfast time, banging the gong. He'd then be out again at lunchtime, banging the gong, and then at dinner time. And that was his sole purpose in life. In the previous episodes, you may recall, we'd moved to Scotland, where dinner was summoned by a bagpiper who charges in, gives us a tune, leaves again. And, of course, bagpipes, you know, always, I think, a good outdoor instrument not to be played in the house. That is indeed how it happens. So Downton's off to a good start, and a lot of the intrigue that we've seen really makes for it to be an engaging series. I think Fellowes is very clever. He's come up with a highbrow type of drama, but it has a wide demographic appeal, because we are engaged in each of the individuals' lives. And I'll just mention a small thing. We began with the music from Downton. Again, when things don't seem to be happening, I think they make very good use of music as a way of bringing a sense of time. And the one thing I think Downton Abbey does, whether it's dealing with the Edwardian period or now into the post-World War I period, is capture that spirit of time, that spirit of place, that really makes for not just a costume drama, not just accurate phrases and speech patterns, but also a sense that the politics and the economics of the time is happening in front of your very eyes as the program progresses. So my recommendation for Sunday night at 9 o'clock, tune in for what is now Series 4 of Downton Abbey and find out what it's like to have your breakfast served with a warm copy of the Sunday Times or the London Times, hot toast, in bed, having nothing else to do but to sit back and let them do it for you.
Your nice, freshly pressed paper, indeed.
Yes. Well, I've moved on in, again, my viewing cycle, and I've got two really interesting choices which are playing both in the city in Marin, in the East Bay, and both, in a strange way, are based on real-life situations. The first is Philomena. It stars Judy Dench, who's now 87, but extremely sprightly. And she plays the role of a mother, a real-life mother in this case, Mrs. Lee, who in the late 1950s was pregnant, unmarried, and had to give her child over to adoption. And in this case, it was sent to Ross Cree, a convent in Ireland. So the basic facts behind the story are there. And again, some of the criticism that we've seen of the Catholic Church in Ireland, around the world, in different types of abuse, in this case, I think really relates to how the adoption process was in place as late as the 1950s and through the 1960s. In fact, the mother in the story, the real-life mother, wanted this story to be told as a way or as a hope that maybe it could lead to change. So Judy Dench meets this journalist. Again, he's another real-life figure, a man by the name of Mr. Smick Smith, who had been both the Times man in Washington and in Moscow, and then fell on a bit of political intrigue with the Labour Party, lost his job, and out of nowhere came to run into the lady through the daughter and decided to write the story. So that's the backstory to this wonderful film, Philomena. And it traces how the adoption process works, because the son is adopted by an American family from Missouri. He ends up in the States, actually ends up working for George Bush, George Bush Sr. in the White House. And in fact, when they get to the States, they discover he is just a few years back died of AIDS. So it's a sad but tragic story. But it's extremely powerful, partly because of the relationship, in this case, between Maggie Smith and the journalist.
Judy Dench.
Yeah, sorry, thank you. Yeah. Well, correction, I'm still back in Downton Abbey. Yes, between Judy Dench and the journalist. In real life, Mrs. Lee never came to the States, so that is an added piece to the story. And I think at the end, it will leave you in a quandary. Who was right? Who was wrong? We certainly know in this case the church was very inhumane. But at the same time, you're going to put the clock back. This is the 1950s, 1960s. And I think it raises a lot of very, very interesting questions about relationships between mothers and children, between convents and adoption. And I think it's a powerful piece of filmmaking that will make you think after you leave the theatre.
Philomena at a theatre near you.
And my final choice, which I really enjoyed, is American Hustle. A very funny film, a satirical film, and in this case based once more on a real-life story, the Abscam crisis or Abscam scandal of the 1980s. David Russell, the filmmaker, has move the story along, but I'll just give a word of advice. Don't blink, because there are a lot of swift plot changes, as in this case, the con man, played by Christian Bale, is led through forging checks, selling false art, into participating in a scam, which ultimately will entrap some leading politicians, which really happened at the time, as part of the story. some good named actors, and you'll recognize them as they come along. Amy Adams plays Sydney. She is the attractive ex-stripper who takes on a persona in the movie. You see her change. She adopts a British accent and calls herself Lady Edith. That's part of the scam. And then Jennifer Lawrence plays the wife, Rosalind, of the con artist. And again, eye candy, something great to look at. But this is a very witty screenplay. And perhaps one of the most important cameo appearances is by Robert De Niro, a mafioso boss with the shaded lenses and all that haunting threat. So a high recommendation if you're looking for a fun movie with a serious theme playing everywhere at the moment, David Russell's movie, The American Hustle.
Thank you, Peter, for your views and for your take on the season of Downton Abbey. I'm going to have that music go underneath me as I offer some other events that are going on. Peter, we'll see you again soon.
Okay, good to see you, David. Happy New Year.
And to you. John Lund's music as the composer to the theme of Downton Abbey. Finishing things out here on Open Air. A reminder that the San Francisco Symphony continues its Bates Love Fest. Mason Bates and Beethoven paired under the auspices and baton of Michael Tilson Thomas. This week, the B-Sides continues by Mason Bates along with Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Next week, Mason Bates' work, Liquid Interface, will be featured. More information about those concerts at sfsymphony.org. Also, Roadshow, the Stephen Sondheim latest incarnation of his musical, which had several names, now is definitively Roadshow, continues under the direction of John Fisher at Theater Rhino through the 19th. Information at therhino.org. If you're looking for a laugh, well, Marga Gomez, everybody's favorite San Francisco lesbian Latina comedian. That's a laugh line in itself. She unveils her latest solo piece, set in the 1970s, a series of vignettes with Gomez inhabiting such characters as a tin-eared singer, an aspiring butch named Dahlia, a Polaroid camera-toting photographer, and others, through March 15th at The Marsh, themarsh.org, for information there. I'm David Latulip. It's been Open Air for Thursday, the 9th of January. Thank you for listening. And I thank Neil Swinkles once again for helping produce the show. Our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. There you can search for the various people that have appeared on Open Air. Hear the past episodes as well. You can also download the latest copy of our KALW program guide, kalw.org. Be well, drive safely, enjoy the week.